Welcome to the podcast, Whiskey and a Map. Stories of adventure and expeditions as told by those who live them. I'm your host, Michael Reinhardt. It has been said that many adventures and expeditions start simply with a map and a glass of whiskey. A desire to go and see the world's wild places. You're invited to pull up a chair, pour yourself a glass of your favorite whiskey, and join us as we hear stories from another one of our friends just returned from the field. We now return back to the Amazon with Yossi Ginsberg.
And we split. And they left and started walking, and again, never forget it, seeing them walk and disappear into the jungle. And that was the last of them. They were never seen again. Both of them, no trace, no sign. Nobody knows. Nobody knows nothing. There was nothing left of them. They were just swallowed, and nobody knows anything. They were never seen again. Marcus and Carl disappeared. And we didn't know that at that time. So Kevin and I went on the raft. And it was a matter, maybe, you know, the beginning excitement. And Kevin now is the boss, just me and him. He tells me what to do and, you know, how to move with the oar and with the sticks. He ties the equipment and we separate two bags, one bag with the important stuff. We'll keep it afloat, tie a couple of empty tank cans. We push the raft and we start. In the beginning, it's fun and we're free and the adventure and the friendship, and it's all beautiful. And nature, amazing nature, of course. I describe all that and don't tell you how, you know, in awe all the time, in the jungle, on the river. This is like, the jungle is unbelievable. And as the time passed, I'm not afraid anymore. I love that. You know, like, I really love that. So we enjoy all that. You know, it's about 3 hours that, you know, we see that the river changes and gets narrow and narrow, and cliffs are building. And Kevin is telling me we better, you know, like, stop, and, you know, like, it looks dangerous. And Carl told us about that, but it was supposed to be a few more hours, and, you know, like, we didn't understand exactly. Anyway, minutes. And the river just got so narrow, like a bottleneck, and it just took us in. And in minutes, you know, there were cliffs on both sides, and we are stuck in a canyon, and there was nothing we could do. Nothing, you know, like, there's no point in, like, trying to. And then we see the rock coming. It was like a huge black rock, and there was nothing we could do, nothing. So, you know, like, we threw ourselves on the raft and just, you know, like, held on to the ropes and just, you know, protected ourselves. And then the crash came. It was like a huge explosion and all the water, and it took a second to understand what happened. We were taken out of the water. Like, the raft hit the rock so hard it climbed on it, and the raft now was hanging on the rock, and the other side was like this huge fall. I mean, huge, like 3 meters, but a mass of water going down, and we are hanging. And all, it's just gushing water all over, and we are on the rock, and, you know, we cannot hear each other, scream, and Kevin is trying to tell me what to do, and we couldn't release ourselves. And Kevin tells me, screaming, you know, like, said, what we do now is, like, there's no other choice. I'll jump, and I'll make it to the right bank, which is the closest bank. You hold the machete. As you see me getting, you know, throw the machete after me, I'll take the machete, I'll cut some vines, I'll tie them together, I'll throw you, put both backpacks on you, I'll pull you out. Crazy, you're going to drown. Don't do it, you know, we cannot split. Don't do it. He said, no, I have to. We cannot stay here when it gets dark. We have to do it now. So he jumps. He leaves the shoes behind. He leaves the shoes behind. And he jumps into the water. He disappears, but luckily he pops up again. And luckily, I managed to throw him the shoes and the machete. And then, I mean, the raft just losing the grip. And the raft goes into the water. And I'm screaming, Kevin, don't leave me, Kevin. And he's, you know, like, and the horror, boom, I fall into that waterfall, this huge rapid, and I'm just swallowed. In 1 second, the entire raft was swollen and taken under the current, under the water. And it looks like a long time. And then the raft finally pops up. And when it pops up, I take the breath of air, I'm holding to the raft, and I turn my head, and that's the last I see of Kevin. I see Kevin there. And then, you know, there's like turn, and that's it. The sight is cut. And then L is, you know, loose because I'm going into the canyon alone. And it's rapid after rapid, waterfall, rocks. This is hard to describe, but I think it was 15 minutes, 20 minutes of going down this canyon. And then the raft in the end broke to pieces. The all the equipment was gone. I was in bare body. And somehow I felt ground under my feet. And I managed to pull myself out. And I was on the right bank, alone, and with nothing.
Surviving that, someone was surely looking out for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's never doubt that this was a miracle. I know for sure. And I knew that moment. But after the exhilaration of just being alive and being saved and a miracle, I suddenly realized I'm alone. However, the first night wasn't that terrible. Yeah, I didn't have nothing. And I was under the cliff, so I had no shelter. I was just on the rocks by the river. So trying to be under a rock. I think the rainy season already began, so it was rainy. It was very wet, scary, all that. But it wasn't that terrible because I knew I'm going to meet Kevin in the morning. Because I saw him, and he saw me. And as it happened, I was on the right bank as he was. So I knew he's coming down. And I knew we were going to meet because it wasn't far. So when the morning came, I climbed on the cliff and I said, I'm going to walk up to meet him. And I walk and I'm screaming. And I realized there's no point in screaming, like the noise of the river and the wind. And this was, you know, this it went first day, second day, third day. I'm on the cliffs and I realized Kevin is not coming. So on the fourth day, I completely collapse, you know, because then I realize I'm alone. And it's terrifying because I know I don't have what it takes to deal with it. You know, I had hope Kevin, the tough guy, but alone, I'm not going to. And I realize I'm going to die a terrible death. You know, it's going to be miserable and painful, a beast, injury, disease. And I cried that night. I felt really sorry for myself. I felt all the elements laughing at me. The great explorer will marry the daughter of the chief, find El Dorado, look at him now. I felt really miserable, really miserable. I knew Kevin is not coming. I thought he died. My thought was, how can he not be here? He must have jumped. That's what I saw. He must have jumped. He felt responsible for me. When he saw me taken, he must have jumped. And without the raft, he probably drowned. And that's what I was thinking. Because otherwise, why wouldn't he show up? So now on the fifth day, I leave the cliffs and I go downriver. Start walking downriver because I know civilization is downriver. I don't know how far it is. I don't know what's going to happen, but I cannot just stay. So I start walking. And then my adventure begins. I walk every day. Now, every day is a huge story. Every single day. Every single day, there's a lot of events. Animals. There's lots of animals. Snakes. Jaguars. And wild boars. I tried to hunt. And I didn't manage. I had no equipment to hunt. So in the beginning, it's very difficult. But I start developing a certain system and I there's a certain routine. Plus, once I find a fruit tree and I climb on the fruit and there's a snake and I actually manage to, you know, I jump off the tree, but then I come back And with a stick, I hit the snake, and I managed to kill the snake and to peel its skin. But I felt invigorated, you know, by killing that snake and by dealing with it. And as the day passed, something very strange happened, Michael. I got intoxicated by my own power. I suddenly discovered that I can deal with it alone. And in a strange way, in my head, I was saying, I don't want anybody to interfere. I'm dealing with it. I don't want rescue. I don't want anything. I can deal with it. So it was kind of like, because I think despite all the desire for adventure, I was very insecure. I was still a young man. So this was like my rite of passage. This is actually what I really look. This is what I came for. And I realized that, and I realized I can deal with it. This was all born there alone in the jungle. I actually felt good. And also, it's logical because it was real survival. And in real survival, you feel good because all your faculties are coming together. You know, all the faculties are alert and empowered to give you a chance to survive. So you feel mentally good and spiritually good and physically tremendous strength and also emotional. Like I was really feeling good. And then I also learned how to deal with the jungle. There was a certain bird running and I kept seeing it. And then one day I found the nest on the ground. It was beautiful, like turquoise eggs. And I opened them and I drank them and it was very tasty. It was probably that season of that bird. So every day I found a nest. So I ate 2 or 3 eggs every day. Sometimes I would keep an egg and eat it later. You know, like I had some system to eat. And other things just as they came in, you know, like a berry or a fruit that was edible. And I didn't eat much, but I ate something. And then at night, I would make myself a shelter. I also had a system. I would look for a buttress tree. And between the roots, because the roots of, you know, the buttress tree are huge roots coming out. So they make like a room between 2 roots. So I would choose, you know, every night in a miraculous way, a tree like that would appear. I considered everything as providence. I really felt like I was watched and cared for. So I would make myself a place to sleep. I had a system. I would clean the rot and put fresh leaves and cut palm fronds, you know, break them with my hands, take a bunch together and cover myself. And then it was raining all the time. But under the palm fronds, what I would do, since there were jaguars around and I could see the paws every day, and I knew they're like prowling around my camps. The fear, the only way to deal with it was actually to hallucinate. I built hallucination. I would have a dream. I would make it up, stories. And then the next day I would improve on it. And I had many, but 4 or 5 settled. So when I would go to sleep, I didn't sleep, but I would start saying, oh, what should I do? Should I go to Kevin's parents? This was one dream. Or my brother in the ranch, or the girl in Brazil, or my trip to Las Vegas. So I had this like, and each one was a huge story that I would make in my head. You know, so all my dreams become the same. Like the girl in Brazil, the love affair, and that guy that I saved them from. In the end, it was dinners at her parents' place and dinner that I would cook for her. And it was all about food. They all became about food. But I had like these stories and it would kept me. It kept me insane, you know, like not to deal. I didn't sleep, but I rested. And that was the night. Now I had problems. My biggest problem was the feet. I contracted the same. So it's basically, you know, walking with wet socks, with mud inside the socks and rubbing the skin. And then with that humidity and constantly, you know, the feet start rotting and there's, you know, it was very painful because discovered my entire feet and it came to a situation where I had no skin.
I actually know what you went through. When I was in Borneo racing an eco challenge, my feet were so wet for so long in that jungle that I got what they used to call trench foot. I know it's very painful. My flesh even started to split open. At an aid station, they had to cut part of my toe off and wrap it up. I finished the race, but every step was painful.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It is brutal. And it doesn't, I didn't know how long I'm going to be there. So it wasn't like, okay, in 2 days, it's going to be over. Like, I didn't know if it's going to be over. And every day it just got worse. And it was it was painful, excruciating pain. But sometimes if I step on a root or a rock or, you know, I was like, like it was like flesh, like explosions of pain. And yet, you see, survival is an amazing thing, you know, because survival is smarter than you and is stronger than your personality. In real survival, it's not about you. The organism takes over. The organism wants to live, independent of your character. So all these traits are the traits of the organism. For example, you see, the pain was incredible. Like, I would never believe that I could go through so much pain and keep on. But my mind didn't buy into it. So I wasn't like feeling sorry for myself. I think it was a survival mechanism. Like, my mind wasn't in, I can't take it and I'm miserable and why me? It was just quiet. So the pain was pain. But it's the mind that creates the suffering aspect of feeling miserable. I just, you know, I was in tremendous pain, but my mind somehow was separated from that. It was quiet. I was amazed, even with all that pain, in a strange way, I enjoyed it, you know, and I think this is also survival, you know, because that spirit increases the chances to survive. You know, if I was all worried and crying all the time, you know, just make me weaker. But I was in awe. I was surprised myself. How can I be in awe of nature when I'm trapped in nature? In a strange way, I never felt, even going through that, I never felt that nature is my enemy. I didn't feel like the jungle was against me. I felt I was stupid. That was part of it, that I put myself in such a situation. I also felt that I'm punished because of my relationship, what happened with Marcus. So I felt, okay, I'm paid. I deserve this. You know, this was another notion that gave me meaning, you know, to all this pain that I'm going through. That I deserve it. You know, I didn't believe Marcus. He had this pain and I was, you know. So it was kind of like almost like purification, like going through, you know. It was very strong time. I definitely wasn't a victim in these days. I wasn't like miserable and brooding. No, I wasn't. Yet there are all kind of incidents. I fell and I got hurt. I was losing a lot of weight. Gradually, I started, you know, like feeling I'm weakening. Now, after 15 days, this was, I think, the 14th or 15 days that I'm alone in these circumstances. As I say, every day is very eventful. And then came this amazing storm, like amazing storm. Like, you know, when they made the movie, it wasn't even near the storm that I experienced. I don't think they had the budget to create such a storm. What literally happened is the Amazon fell down, you know? Huge trees were coming down because it was so much water that the roots had nothing to hold on. You know, the roots in the Amazon are flat. They don't go in. They stay on the surface because there's no nourishment in the soil. The nourishment is on the surface of the jungle. But with all this water, trees were falling down, and huge tree takes everything on its way. And I'm there, and trees collapsing near me, and it's like war. It's like explosions, and the land is trembling. And I was so inexperienced. You know, I didn't think about it. I was too close to the river. I didn't even give it a thought. And then the river came. Again, it was providence that it was the first light. Otherwise, if it would have happened at night, I would have died. But it was the first light, and the river came. It took, I think, seconds before it was higher than my head. And I couldn't touch the ground. And the current was pulling me to the river. Even though the flood came in, the current was reversed. It was taking me to the river. And now, telling you, this is hard to believe. There was no river. I saw it with my own eyes. Otherwise, I wouldn't believe it. There was no river. The river completely from bank to bank was only trees. There was no water. There were thousands of trees taken down. You wouldn't see the water. It was all trees. Unbelievable, you know? But imagine what a storm this was. It was a huge storm. So now I'm in the flood and I'm barefoot and I just, the shoes are around my neck. I managed to save the shoes because at night I would take my shoes off. And I'm swimming, holding one tree, pulling, pushing, you know, like that, fighting for my life. And I managed to get to a hill and escape the flood. So now I'm on that hill and everything is covered with water around. And I wait. It took me 2 days. I was trapped there for 2 days. So when it's safe enough, it's already 17 days that I'm alone. And I'm coming down from the hill and I feel the pain so much in my feet that I cannot, because of the angle, you know, there's too much pressure. So I go down on my knees and elbows. It's easier to crawl downhill, not to put so much pressure on my feet. And I'm crawling down. And at that moment, suddenly I hear a very strong noise and I realize an airplane is coming. It's clear. It's an airplane. So at that time, I jump on my feet and, you know, like that surge, like they're looking for me. But the airplane comes so fast and so high. I even see it for a split second. I see a white airplane deep in the high and too fast and not looking. And then, you know, this was too much. So that surge, you know, when I saw that airplane and then the airplane disappeared. And I fall and I start crying. And I didn't cry for many, you know, since that day on the cliff. I didn't cry. I was like very strong. And now I felt like I wanted to die. So it was there, is my face in the mud. And I was crying. And it was a relief, you know. I didn't cry for many days, and this was like good just to cry. And also I felt like I giving up. I'm not continuing, you know. And then, you know, this is a bit of a strange story. It's hard for me even to tell you, but I'm just want you to trust me that this is the experience as I tell you. I suddenly hear somebody else crying. Now, it's not logical. I'm alone there in the jungle. It's like I've been there for 17 days. But I hear somebody else crying. And what it does, it makes me stop crying. I stop crying. I raise my head. And it's like I hear the cry. So I get up. And as I walk a little bit towards the cry, I see like a young girl. And she's indigenous. She has like a tattoo. Like she has three dots here on her chin. Thing like that, black hair. I look at her, and then suddenly I have a realization. So what am I doing? If the airplane went, it's probably going to come back. What am I wasting time crying here? I have to make it quickly to the river because there'll be a chance from the bank to wave to the... So I start screaming at her. We must make it to the river. And I start like talking to her. Come, you know, like the airplane will come back. And I grab her and I start walking with her. And I don't stop talking to her. And you're going to see, I'm going to take care of you. We'll go to the river, I'll build you a camp, and I'll go to the bush and I'll find the eggs and I'll give you food. But you don't stop now, you know, we have to make it. I walk with her talking like that. And then night comes, we didn't make it to the river. And I make a camp. But this time, I choose a tree wide enough for two. And I make place for two. And I break more palm frond to cover two. And then I tell her, come, you know, I just want your warmth. You know, we'll exchange warmth. Come closer. And I hug her. And then I see there's nobody in my arm. And I kind of like got really shocked. Because this was real. Like this wasn't in my head. I made a camp for her. It's not in my head. I actually talked to her and I made her a place to sleep. And also, I didn't imagine her. So it wasn't like all my hallucinations that I make them up. I didn't make this up. I didn't decide I'll invent a girl and I'll pretend I'm this happened to me. So I was completely confused. And my take on it was that I'm losing my mind. That was like, I got scared. Said I'm losing my mind. In retrospective, this grew, you know, like that story in retrospective became like kind of like one of the miracles that happened to me, because she came in a moment where I was destroyed, desolated, gave up, in despair, and then she appears. And the other thing is that psychologically it's very interesting, because I mean, you can say this is my subconscious, you know, maybe, I don't know, I didn't do anything, but I believe it's probably my own imagination, but it wasn't contrived. So this happened, like I didn't plan, I'll pretend there is a girl. There was a girl. So why a girl? Why not somebody strong to help me? And that's very interesting, because what gave me power is that somebody needs me. That's what helped me. So it was very clever, but I didn't do it. What is subconscious if it's subconscious? I just still don't know how to explain it exactly. It's like it's a mystery for me. But it was a miracle, because it took me through that day. And then 19 days, 18 days, 19 days, you know, like the last days were very, very tough, because I had no power. To understand, after the flood, there was no food. Nothing. I ate eggs. There were no eggs anymore. You know, the flood washed everything. So I ate nothing, nothing at all for days. No food, nothing. And I became emaciated completely. I was just skin. No, nothing else, just skin and bones. And my feet were raw. Because of that flood, there were swamps. And you couldn't tell, because it's all covered with foliage. And twice I fell into swamps. And the swamps are hours of fighting the mud until I got out of the swamp. And then I fell into another swamp. And then another hours, you know, until I got out of the second swamp. And I was exhausted. I just couldn't continue. I was lying there outside the swamp. And I realized I cannot continue. I just have no power anymore. And it wasn't that I gave up. I didn't give up. I didn't want to give up. But I was just completely exhausted, and my feet wouldn't carry me anymore. You know, my feet were completely raw, and they wouldn't carry me anymore. And I knew I wanted to leave. I didn't want to die. And I knew that the only chance I have to survive is if I collapse, I have to collapse on the river, not inside the forest. So I have to push myself to the river, and then I collapse. But here, I have to make one more effort. But I couldn't. I just couldn't bring myself. And then again, this is like surreal. But I suddenly realized I see something. You know, I was in the jungle enough time. I spent a few weeks with Carl, and I learned a lot from him. And there's one thing that is the fire ant. The fire ant, it lives symbiotically with a tree. The tree is called the Palo Santo. And the fire ant lives on the Palo Santo. And I suddenly, from there, I realize I can see something, and I see it's the Palo Santo covered with the fire ant. Now, this is nasty fire ant. One bite makes a warrior cry. It's like, it's painful. And I got one bite before, and I saw Kevin get a bite, and Carl get a bite, and I see Carl jumping into the water, and Kevin crying, you know, like the tough guy. This was really painful. And I think it was instinct. I don't remember thinking. It was just instinct. I crawled to that tree. And then I raised myself against the tree, and I started shaking the tree, and I collapsed. Fire ants on me. And, you know, like they started biting me, and it was like, it's like blazing hot rod touching your skin. It's like burn, and another burn, and another burn, you know. And I had, I don't know how many fire ants on me, and I was like on fire, and the pain was so, I mean, I was just like a torch. I was burning, and I could run. I didn't feel my feet at all. I just felt the fire. I was inside that fire, and I ran like that, and I made it to the river. And when I got to the river, I collapsed. And at that time, I knew I'm not going to get up on my feet again. I knew it was over. This is it. So I laid there. And after a while, I realized it was 19 days. I realized that I wouldn't last much longer, and maybe I'm going to faint. It already happened to me a couple of times that I lost consciousness, and you know, I didn't know how many hours, but I just woke up again. And I knew it can happen, and I lose consciousness. And then, so I realized I have to leave a mark. There was a playa there, which is very rare. I have to leave a mark on the playa, so if an airplane's come, they see. I couldn't stand, so I did it crawling. I started rolling logs, and I created my initial Y, big one. And then I said, okay, they will see that if they come. And then I crawled. There was one more incident, which is a minor but very interesting, is that while doing that, I found a turtle. And it was actually a big turtle. And I didn't eat in like 5 days, nothing. So immediately I thought, I'm going to take a rock and break the, you know, like the shell, or, and I'll eat the turtle. I just tear it up and eat it. And there was like something strange happened. The turtle brought its head up and it just looked at me. It was like, I don't know how to explain, but the moment I saw the eyes of the turtle, I was washed with so much compassion. And I got scared. I said, you know, like, there's no way I'm going to. I talked to the turtle, said, you are my brother. I'm not going to hurt you. And I didn't touch the turtle. So I don't know why, but I didn't touch the turtle. I didn't eat it. I didn't kill it. I let it go. And then I crawled away from the river and lay there about 100 yards away, so another flood wouldn't take me. And that's it. I didn't get up anymore. So the 19th night came. The 20th day, I didn't move. And then the 20th night, as dusk is coming, I'm in my hallucination, when suddenly there's like a bzzz, like a buzz. And I'm sure it's a bee or a wasp. I try to chase the bee or the wasp. And it's like the noise is really strong now. I open my eyes. There's no bee. There's no wasp. But the noise is very strong. So I raise my head and look. And I see a canoe coming up river. And it's the engine, the outboard engine, making the noise. I see the canoe. And as I see, the canoe is landing on that playa. And I hear noise of people. And before I know it, like two people jump out. And immediately they turn the canoe around. They push it back to the river and they jump on it. And they sail away. So I'm shocked. Wait, you know, I cannot scream. I jump on my feet, not jump, but I bring myself up to my feet. I can hardly stand. And I'm standing there. I cannot run. I don't manage to scream. And just canoe just going down. And then almost as it veers and disappears, suddenly somebody turns around. And as it turns around, I hear a scream. Yossi, don't move. It's Kevin. Kevin is in that canoe with three other people. And the canoe is turning back, and Kevin runs towards me, and, you know, don't move, don't move, don't move. He runs to me, and then I fall into his arms, and the people come. There's like three people there. One of them comes with a tuna can in his hand, and he opens the tuna can, and he gives me, and I eat the tuna like that. And I said, quick, we have to. It's dangerous here, you know, like the river. We have to go. Kevin carries me. There's no weight, you know, like nothing for it. And he puts me in the boat. They put a blanket on me, and we go downstream for a couple of hours. And only there we make a camp. And then we sit and we start talking. So apparently they were searching for 3 days. Kevin, first of all, he walked and searched for me like I was sure he would. But we didn't meet because there's different stratas to the canyon and there's no trail. So he was walking on another level, and We just didn't meet. It probably is as a moment where we passed each other. So after 4 days, like me, he realized he didn't find me on the canyon. And he jumped into, he built a raft, made a makeshift raft. He jumped into the water and was on the raft for 2 days until he was found by two hunters, a father and son, from the Uchupiamona. They took him to the village. They cared for him for a few days. And then they took him down to the jungle town, Rurrenabaque. There he told the authorities, an airplane came not to search, just to pacify the authorities. Nobody believed. Nobody. Nobody at any level, even the indigenous people, they said, no way. No gringo. One of us will not survive. A gringo, no way. But Kevin didn't give up, and he found somebody that had a boat, the first motor boat in that jungle town was Tico Tudela. And without money, only with passion and burning desire, he convinced Tico to take him upriver. But Tico never went so far up the Tuichi. So he went to the Chupiamona, the only people that live in the Madidi, and two Chupiamona others, not the people that found Kevin, two hunters. And for 3 days they went and became more dangerous. Twice they wanted to return, and Kevin insisted, no, please, another hour. Then it was dusk already, and Kevin realized he cannot risk their life. It's too dangerous. They saw that playa as an opportunity to turn the boat instead of the maneuver. They landed just to turn, and they landed where I collapsed the night before, which is, again, impossible if you think about like the vastness of the Amazon and the river. So that's how my life were saved. And of course, after that, you know, they took me to the town and they took care of me. And to our shock, when we got to La Paz, we realized that Marcus and Carl never made it. This was a big shock for us. My life was saved. Kevin saved me. Kevin came back. It's like an amazing story. He went back to the States, and I went back to Israel.
Did you ever return to the Amazon?
About 10 years later, I, for different reasons, arrived in South America. And I thought it's a good opportunity to go back for closure, to say thank you to the people that saved my life. I went to Rurrenabaque, and I met Tico, the guy that owns the boat. And I said, you know, I want you to take me to the Uchupiamona. We did this expedition 8 hours upriver to the Uchupiamona. And I came to the village, and it was a huge celebration because it's a very remote village. And they rarely see anybody from the outside. And so there was a big celebration around it. I was 10 years away from South America. My Spanish was very rusted by then. I still tried to make a speech to thank them for saving our lives. You know, there was a festivity and food and dance, and it was really beautiful. And then they came to me, the three leaders. They had like a triumvirate, you know, like the three leaders. Alejandro, Zenon, and Guido. And they grabbed me and they talked to me and said, you know, like, you came to thank us for saving your life. But we are dying. This entire village is dying. And maybe you can do something to help us, to save our lives. And of course, such circumstances, what can you say? You say, I'll do anything. I'll do anything for you. But what happened? They said, the youth, they leave the village and they don't come back. One after the other, they go down to the jungle town downriver and they get any dirty job, but they won't come back. And we see them. And, you know, the only old people will remain and we will perish. We will perish. They said, look, we have an idea. We know what we can do, but we need help. I said, what? I said, look, there's a lake not far from here. Chalalan. It's the most beautiful, pristine lake. And we plan to build a resort on the lake. And that resort in that beautiful jungle, you know, like that we know so well, this will save us because our youth will work and they will earn money as guides and cooks and then maids and you know, they'll take pride in our culture again, and it will be. So we want to build this resort. And can you help us? No. You know, at life and you know, like middle of the jungle, how can you build a resort? You know, like it's very hard to get there. You know, like there's no flight. There's only one military flight once a week, and it's on a grass landing strip. So when it rains, there's no flights. It canceled. And it rains a lot. And the road that leads you from La Paz to the jungle is called the Death Road, the most dangerous road on the world. And then you have to take 8 hours boat upriver. How can you have an operation? And money, who's going to give them money? So I just saw this is like, they just, you know, like, they have no clue. They live in the middle of the jungle. They have dreams, but they have no clue. But I couldn't tell them. What would I tell them? You know, I told them I will do anything. And that this is a great idea, and that, of course, I will help them. And what else can you say in such circumstances? So then I left. I was in L.A. I remember every day you go to sleep, and I know these people wait for me because they don't see people. And I'm not just a people, you know. My story becomes huge in this area, huge. So I found it hard to fall asleep, you know. And I talked to a few people, but they say, you're crazy, you know. Indians in the middle of the jungle, what? Just, you know, like nobody even would consider anything. So me and my girlfriend, we made a raffle and we organized a party and we talked to all our friends and we got a club in L.A. that gave us the club as donation. And we did this party and we raised like almost $10,000. I took that money and I flew with it to Bolivia. And I came all the way up to the village again, and I gave them the money. I said, this is the money for the project. This is where it starts here. This is the village money. I put the money, and we started the project. Now, I had no clue about nothing. I stayed there to do the project with them. I stayed in the village for 3 years. I lived there for 3 years. And it went gradually. I didn't plan it exactly like that. But initially, I started working on that. Seeing Chalalan was beautiful. It's like somebody painted it. It was too beautiful to believe that it's real. You know, just the perfect lake with so much wildlife. And they said it was so pristine because nobody dared to hunt there because there's an evil spirit that lives there. And they're afraid of it. So that's why it's completely intact, because nobody's logging there, nobody's touching, because there's that spirit. It's a bad spirit. Okay.
An interesting place to put an eco lodge where it's already occupied by an evil spirit.
Yeah. But the youth said, this is beautiful, so we I go with them. And this is like, there's nothing there. It's the first expedition. And we decided to start. So, you know, they make a lean-to. My girlfriend is with me. And we stay there. And I think it was 2 or 3 nights. And we start making just on the lake. We're planning. We're going to do here, there. And then middle of the night, you know, like strong hands are like shaking me. I'm with my girlfriend in a tent. They wake me up. Yossi, come. They pull me. They bring me to the lean-to. The wife of one of the leaders, the wife of Senon, is lying there, and she's dead. You know, she's stiff as a stone. She's not breathing. They all, you know, on top of her, trying to do strange things. They couldn't wake her up, so they called me, and I said, you know, just, I pushed them a bit away, and then I gave her, you know, like, I gave a mouse to nose. You know, I was blue air to her nose. I swear, Michael, this is like so surreal. But it's real. I brought her back. She came back. So she wakes up. And it's like, everybody's shocked. And then after like 15 minutes that she recovers, she tells us it was the evil spirit. He kidnapped her in her sleep and was dragging her to the river. And she was fighting him and she ran away. And, you know, she died. She was really dead, you know. She was not breathing. So in the morning, they all take their stuff and they go away. No more project, nothing. They go back to the village. They're afraid. So another story begins. There was an ethnobotanist there in the jungle town, American, David Williams, beautiful man, with his wife, Sandy, and their son, Natako. And he's like doing research on the source of peanuts. So he introduces me to a friend of his, Vesti Pakos, which is like a herpetologist. He's a snake and reptile researcher, and he's like this madman. And he also introduces me to a shaman woman, like a shaman in La Paz. And I really befriend her, and we become really close, this shaman. Every time I'm in La Paz, I spend time with her. So I remember that she's like, she's one of the brujas, you know, one of the witches of the, you know, the Aymara culture. So I go and I take her and I bring her to the jungle to chase the spirit away. And we do like a huge ceremony for 3 days, and she chases the spirit, and then they agree to come back. But now it's already a few months. The money runs out because I pay for the fuel and somebody is sick and we need to take him to a hospital. And, you know, like the money becomes the money of the community. And within a few months, no more money, gone. How do you continue the project? In the meantime, I educate myself because I don't know anything. You know, I'm not a professional, not in tourism and not in environment or zoology or nothing. You know, I have no training that is appropriate for that. But I made contact with the WRI, the World Resource Institute, and then sent me articles. And I read these articles about the Amazon. And I learn a lot from the article, and I get a lot of ideas. And when I read this article, I see that the economic value of renewable is greater than the economic value of non-renewable. And that is a moment of enlightenment for me, because what I realize is that a living forest makes more money than a destroyed forest. And that gives me an idea. It's simply better business, instead of exploiting the jungle, is to harvest it sustainably and keep it alive, because renewable resources worth more money than non-renewable. So this is like, it brings me an idea. And I decide to make a project all about that. And so I have this idea, and I decide I'm going to fly to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to present them my idea. I managed to get to Washington, D.C. with the little money that I have left. And I don't know anybody. Yes, I do know the World Resource Institute, but I don't know them really, you know, like just was communication by letters. So I stand in the phone booth and it's cold. It's December or something like that. It's like freezing in D.C. And I open the yellow pages and I make phone calls, you know, like cold calls. And maybe after like half an hour, I get one organization that tells me they're willing to meet me. It's like the Inter-American Development Bank. So I go to that meeting and I tell them my idea, and I tell them about the indigenous people and that so isolated, and yet they love the forest and they're the keepers of the forest. But the youth is abandoning, you know, because they don't want to live in poverty. So they go down to the jungle town and never come back, and this culture is about to disappear. And how brave they are, and they came up with this idea, and they're going to build that resort, and the resort not only going to save the village, but also going to save the forest, because renewable resources. So I give them all that big talk. And to my surprise, this is my first meeting, my only meeting, first meeting in Washington, D.C. The first organization I meet. And I asked for a grant. I make a calculation and I ask for a grant of $250,000. So we can do the project. The shock, you know, sometimes life is unbelievable. They tell me they cannot give $250,000 because the minimum they can give is $1,250,000. $1,250,000. In one meeting, one single meeting in Washington, D.C., first time I arrived, I asked for $250,000 and they give me $1,250,000. This is the year 92. It's a lot of money. The thing is, they don't write a check and they don't give me anything. They give me a promise, but they give me a book that size, really thick book. It's empty. I have to write the book, all surveys and reports and studies. And once I give them all that complete, then they can process it and they will give me the grant. It took a year to write that book at a huge sacrifice. And there's many, many, many stories of what happened to me and Duccio Piamona in this year. And how he persisted and how many evil people tried to come between us. And I learned so much about the business of saving the world. Most of the people that were in this business needed to go home and save themselves first. It was as scrupulous and as cutthroat and as competitive. But anyway, I learned a lot. And against all odds, we built that resort. We built Chalalan. And Chalalan saved the Chupiamonas. Chalalan saved the entire region. And Chalalan, until this very day, is the most successful resort in the Medidi, in the Bolivian Amazon. And it's world famous and won many, many, many awards. And it's a huge privilege to be a co-founder of this incredible task.
What a great project and outcome.
3 years that I lived with the Uchupiamonas, I became an Uchupiamona myself. I went hunting and gathering, and I hung out with them, and I spoke their language, and I danced their dances, and I buried their dead, and I birthed the newborn, and I was at the wedding, and I got married myself, but not to the daughter of the chief, actually to my girlfriend that came with me from L.A. But we got married in a shamanic ritual in the middle of the Amazon, and that's how my childhood dream was fulfilled. I did find my tribe. I did become one of them. I did marry in the middle of the jungle, and I did find my treasure, because these stories are a tremendous treasure. My story is the biggest treasure I could find.
Yossi, what lessons have these adventures taught you?
Never underestimate the power of naivete. Maybe this is the first insight that I say has taken from that. If you don't know it's impossible, it is possible. And secondly, I learned from the jungle so much about the wisdom of the jungle, the wisdom of nature. Jungle was never my enemy. It was always my home and always will remain my home.
Yossi, thank you for joining us and sharing your amazing stories.
Thank you, Michael, for hosting me. I hope this will enlighten your audiences in some way. They'll find something in this story for themselves. This is the treasure that I have, is the beauty of this story and the transformation that it can bring to other people. Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Yossi, how can people follow you and learn more about your adventures and projects?
My name, Yossi Ginsberg. That's YOSSIGHINSBERG, YossiGinsberg.com. My website, and anyone that want to find me, to talk to me, to ask any question, are very, very welcome, and I'll be glad to hear from your audiences. My book is called Jungle, and thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you down the road when we get together again, share a glass of whiskey, and hear more stories of adventure as told by those who live them. Until then, check us out at michaeljreinhart.com, where you'll find more of my work as an adventure photojournalist. Photos, videos, and articles of interesting people, mysterious places, and exotic cultures from the wild places of the world.